Uncle Don, recidivist, freelance curmudgeon, back on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia, with my 331st porcupine petting zoo. Israel exults at the news that Iran has admitted a construction of another uranium processing facility under a mountain in Qom. Analysts determined that this plant, being smaller than the main one, must be for producing bomb-grade isotopes. I wonder what they would have deduced if this newly discovered plant were larger than the other, but never mind. One Israeli official is quoted as saying, "It is a vindication for Israel and supports its position for the last 10 years that Iran is not being frank and honest in its dealings with the International Atomic Energy Agency." This from the representative of a nation which is known to have secretly built as many as 200 nuclear weapons while fervently denying their existence to the IAEA and all comers. Chutzpah is a Yiddish word for brazen nerve. Israel has chutzpah in spades. That quotation from the Israeli analyst was printed as a small sidebar in the Globe and Mail newspaper. There was no mention of the hypocrisy of Israel in its criticism of Iran. Why not? Print media are in trouble. Advertisements supporting newspapers are decreasing. Ken West Global, publisher of the National Post, the Vancouver Sun and Province, and a stable of other papers, is under bankruptcy protection. The Canadian flagship, Globe and Mail, is in the red. Independent newspapers, ones previously the property of dedicated publishers, are an endangered species, gobbled up by conglomerates owned by stockholders interested in profits, not news. For them, news is just filler between ads. They have no concern for muck-raking journalism, which might offend some of their advertisers. No paper carrying full-page color ads for GM cars wants to have its journalists pursue the failings of that corporation. To a very real extent, advertisers control what we see and hear. Until the last century, most cities had two or more daily papers. They actually competed with each other in digging up stories, putting trained journalists on the streets trying to scoop each other. Few cities have such competition anymore. Look at Vancouver with its two papers, Tweedledee and Tweedledum, both owned by CanWest. Most stories in any contemporary paper come from wire services or press releases. There are armies of public relations specialists working for corporations, governments, and interest groups, cranking out press releases tailored to look like news reports. Lazy editors pluck these from their fax machines and email, printing them intact. We read these items thinking they're the fruit of journalism, not propaganda mills. I'm aware of this every time I read a newspaper article. I find it more and more common for major papers to print slanted products of public relations outfits. By carefully reading between the lines and integrating their content with what I know of the world, I try to decipher the real story. That item about Israeli concern for Iran's nuclear program is one such article that cannot be taken at face value. Mike Capstick, a former Canadian colonel, is now a director of the nonprofit Peace Dividend Trust, promoting private enterprise in war-torn countries. He sees signs of success for our Afghan mission due to certain trends. He said, "You're starting to see how development of an Afghan middle class that looks like a middle class. Historically, that's what's been necessary for democracy and human rights." He explains that people with regular jobs who can buy the accoutrements of a better life will be the building blocks of democracy. Furthermore, he stated, "Empowered communities are where we see spontaneous human security developing. Empowered communities and communities where the people are willing to stand up against the Taliban and say, 'This is a school that we built and we contributed to, and as a result, you're not going to touch it.'" Let me take Capstick's analysis at face value. If this is true and fertile ground for democracy exists when a middle class grows and people become empowered, does the same process work in reverse? When the middle class shrinks, distribution of wealth becomes polarized, individuals become less empowered, and public institutions, like schools, are destroyed, is this an indication of the failure of democracy? See where I'm going? In our province, we have a secret of government centralizing power while privatizing those areas of the commons which we hold jointly by virtue of citizenship. Public schools are being starved even as we subsidize private ones. The minimum wage has been frozen for years, while higher bureaucrats and politicians are lavished with pay increases. Private clinics abound, while insured medical services are starved. Gordon Campbell throws millions at his pet Olympic party, while lines at food banks grow. He dumps a hated FST onto consumers while gifting corporations. Our federal government likewise shifts taxes toward workers and consumers while downloading responsibilities onto provinces, which in turn dump them onto municipalities, which haven't the funds to fulfill them. We're jointly becoming poorer at the bottom, even as the wealthy do well. I suggest that Capstick may be right. Afghans are developing a basis for democracy, even as we Canadians lose ours. I expect that an ideal democratic government would not be afraid to admit its mistakes as readily as it takes credit for its accomplishments. By this standard, Canada's not doing well. Canada's Military Complaints Commission is holding hearings to determine whether our soldiers were complicit in turning over captive Afghans to their nation's forces for torture. A positive finding would mean that those who made the policy and those who executed it could be tried nationally and internationally for war crimes. Canada is signatory to the International Criminal Court Treaty, so failure to prosecute here would open the door for any signatory to prosecute. Rather than allow a fair and open inquiry, Harper's government is throwing all the monkey wrenches and legal shenanigans available into the works to derail it. Subpoenas witnesses planning to testify before the inquiry are threatened by telling them that they would be violating sections of the Anti-Terrorism Act by speaking out. Damn it, we were warned by saner heads that passing these broad draconian laws in the wake of the creation of the World Trade Crater would leave to their later misuse, and they are sadly vindicated. Government lawyers warn that testimony could violate the Canada Evidence Act, another fine piece of work to muzzle the truth. Besides these ploys, it appears that Harper's regime is stalling in anticipation of replacing the current commissioner with a less conscientious person on the 11th of December, when Peter Tinsley's appointment ends. This is further proof that today's conservative regime is anything but conservative as the term was formerly used. They're an unprincipled batch of power-hungry freaks who see the laws and institutions of our democratic society not as a framework within which they must operate, but as impediments to their doing whatever they damned well please. Here in B.C., we face a daunting fiscal situation. Campbell's attempts to make B.C. the province with the lowest business taxes have come back to bite us in the butt. Sure, taxes are low, but tax rates and starvation minimum wages will not alone persuade a business to locate in our province. People of high incomes have accountants and sharp lawyers to assure that they dodge most taxes anyway. It is amenities that attract. A company wants a decent social structure where it moves its executives. They want a low crime rate, clean streets, quality schools, and a social safety net providing for the destitute. Combating crime, cleaning and repairing streets, running good schools and housing the homeless require money, money that's not available when taxes are minimized. Our cupboard is bare due to Campbell government's obsession with tax cuts. Well, tax cuts aren't the only reason money's not there for public facilities and a social safety net. Campbell believes he must lavish benefits on his friends. Last year, senior bureaucrats were given an unsolicited gift of up to 21% raises. This was rationalized as a need to recruit and retain top civil servants. Meanwhile, salaries of those working under them have been frozen. Speaking as one who has worked as a minion in several bureaucracies, I'll say that those of the higher ranks are impediments to achieving functions as often as they are expediters. While they attend their meetings and three-hour lunches, their flunkies grind away doing the real work. Arbitrary commands of big shots must often be circumvented in order to get any real work done. Are bloated salaries necessary to retain the rare talents of senior bureaucrats? Well, then, perhaps they're in the wrong field of work. Maybe their places should be filled with people dedicated to public service rather than those feathering their private nests. The head of BC's civil service, the one who finally approved those huge increases for the indispensable, is leaving. Her replacement will be paid $63,000 a year more than she earned, making him better paid than the premier himself. Can we justify this in a time of retrenchment and restraint? George Bush the Lesser isn't the only out-of-power war criminal to rake in the big bucks on the lecture circuit. Tony Blair, among the most hated men in Britain, has pulled in about $25 million in fees in the years since he left office. It looks like a career in high office is just a prelude to the real goal of making a fortune by explaining and rationalizing one's sins before paying audiences. Might this be Harper's secret goal? Could he be laying track for the day when he can suck money from masses of people who'll pay to hear him explain why he has been such a callous, mean-spirited SOB in office? Does someone in the Prime Minister's office have a sense of humor? How else to explain his concert debut saw him playing a doper's song on the grand piano with Yo-Yo Ma as accompanist? I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. If anyone has a different interpretation of those lyrics, I've yet to hear it. I thought I knew something about the insurance industry, as my father was into reinsurance, or the business of taking on some of the risk from ordinary casualty companies. I'm behind the times, as I've never heard of cat bonds or catastrophe bonds. Cat bonds are a way an insurer can spread the risk associated with severe weather events. It has the function of reinsurance with a twist. A company may hold a number of policies in a place like, for instance, New Orleans, knowing that they could suffer billions of dollars in potential losses if another Type 3 or above hurricane hits, they issue cat bonds. The buyers of these bonds wager that such a hurricane will not hit this year. If they're right and the city is spared, they'll receive their principal back with high interest. If they're wrong, they lose everything and the insurance company keeps the principal, using the money to offset lost claims. In this respect, it's a form of hedging their bets. Fair enough, there's an opportunity here for those with money to spare to take a gamble. If it helps spread risk, it is providing a legitimate financial function. But the article I read explaining this cat bond thing said that one big customer for these instruments is pension funds. Corporations are whining about how they haven't the assets to back their pension obligations, causing panic among workers with defined benefit plans. Why do these funds lack sufficient assets? Because corporation pension managers have taken risks in search of large returns. Haven't governments learned anything by this current crisis? Don't they see that pension funds should only be allowed to make guaranteed investments like AAA bonds? For God's sake, if we're going to suffer through a disaster like our fiscal collapse, at least it should have been a learning experience. Here comes another hidden subsidy from our indebted federal government supporting the illusion that the Vancouver Olympics will not be a money sinkhole. Canada's Minister of Heritage, currently headed by UNBC's most successful stuffed shirt alumnus James Moore, has generously spent $447,000 in public money to buy high-end tickets for members of Parliament and the Senate. He claims that these well-paid individuals will pay for those tickets, but I'll believe that when the checks are cashed. That nearly $500,000 is just the down payment. Any guesses as to who will pay first-class airfares to Vancouver and back to Ottawa? Who will pay for the 5-star hotels at premium rates, the limousines, and fancy meals? Remember, these are times of government restraint when we cannot provide for the unemployed and students, among others, struggling to survive. The once thriving community of Barrier, just north of Kamloops, has struggled since the area was ravaged by forest fires and the loss of their sawmill. Its 3,450 residents have looked for a hook which could draw outsiders to visit their village and drop their money. They can't have the world's largest cross-country skis. Those are in Hundred Mile House. Lillooet has the world's largest chainsaw. Prince George has Mr. PG, God's help us. What to do? Someone pointed out to village fathers and mothers that Barrier happens to rest on the same latitude as Stonehenge, so an idea was born. Since Britain was not amenable to selling Stonehenge to North Americans, recalling the way the London Bridge was spirited off to Arizona, Barrier Nix decided to build a replica. Barrier Stonehenge will not be a tabletop model of but a full-scale reproduction, oriented just like the original to capture the equinoxes and solstices. It should be, in the original meaning of the word, awesome, especially if they choose to construct it as was the original. Experts calculate that that took 30 million man-hours to build. I suspect that heavy machinery will be used on the recreation. The construction will be done in an area that used to be an airstrip, probably with an eye to attracting alien spacecraft and intergalactic tourists. Here's the pitch for that massive project as explained by City Councilor Glenn Stanley. He said this will give North Americans a chance to experience the magnificence of Stonehenge and, quote, it would save you from driving all the way to England. At first, I thought Obama had made a huge mistake in making a personal pitch to the International Olympic Committee for awarding Chicago a future Olympics. Now I suspect that he was crazy like a fox. His aggressive promotion was an assault on the usual procedure of bribing and currying members of this self-promoting outfit. He failed to do the proper bowing and scraping and presentation of lavish gifts, thus assuring that his hometown would be rejected. This saved Chicago from the feeding frenzy of preparations and massive expense involved in Olympic hosting. We see from the current mess in Vancouver Whistler that being a venue for these games is a honey trap for cities. It makes a mess of normal activities while leaving a legacy of underused, oversized venues as well as huge debt. Yes, promoters promise many benefits to accompany such an exercise, but the benefits flow to few, while the costs are left with the many. If Obama's goal was to torpedo the prospects of Chicago's Babbitts, he was smarter than I thought. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. From my window here in the spacious studios of CFUR, I overlook a vast two-story multipurpose room which is usually vacant at this time of day. Throughout the summer when the university was almost empty, on bright days and gloomy, all the lights were on in this room. Throughout the year, in class times and out, I walk by empty classrooms, fully illuminated. The University of Northern British Columbia calls itself Canada's Green University, a claim belied by their profligate use of hydropower. A nice slogan, but hollow. Green is a term thrown about these days with great abandon. It's as meaningless as the label free range. Anyone can use it as window dressing. Take the Green Olympics, for instance. Remember the claim that 2010 would show the world how an Olympics could be green? That label seems to have disappeared beneath news of energy and resources wasted in preparation for the Games. It may be a myth that Inuit have 100 words for snow, but those who spend their time sliding downhill on the stuff differentiate between types, and they're fussy. No light, fluffy snow for these folks. They want hard, icy snow, the kind that the gods don't provide on demand. Since nature cannot be counted upon to provide the right material, even with an average natural snowfall in Whistler of 10 meters, human intervention is required. Staff on the ski hills have already begun spraying artificial snow on the slopes. Vanuk has spent $17.6 million on snowmaking equipment for the mountain this year. They increased the size of the reservoir supplying water for snow guns, preparing to use 500 million liters this season. There's no estimate available for the amount of electricity needed to provide the compressed air that fires these guns, but you can bet it's plenty. So pray tell, what is green about blowing 500 million liters of water, equivalent to the volume of 200 Olympic swimming pools, into the air to supplement 10 meters of real snow? What other resources are being squandered to create the perfect artificial environment for a sport that used to require no more than a pair of barrel staves in a frozen hillside? Green my foot. For years, I've written and called local and provincial officials complaining of a growing invasion of unlicensed vehicles on our roads, in our parks, and through our wild areas. Some of the operators of ATVs, trail bikes, and snowmobiles are responsible with their machines, but we don't see these people. We see the ones who rip up and down our roads and through the woods. They are, as a class, a batch of arrogant bastards who don't care about the damage they do or the danger they pose for others. Finally, our provincial government proposes to license drivers of these damned things and force them to insure their toys. We're the last province in Canada to do so. When it comes to off-road vehicles, we're truly in the Wild West. Now, once regulation is in effect, it remains to be seen whether this will be a paper exercise. or whether it is enforced. Another batch that we, on the outskirts of town, have with our worthy citizens is the habit of some who dump their garbage and wild animal parts along our roadways. We never walk our road without a plastic bag, and we never return with it empty. On my informal slob index, I declare the winners, behind hunters of disposals of offal, to be drinkers of Tim Hortons coffee and Budweiser beer. Their waste is the bulk of what we clean up. Some sweet day I hope to see takeaway containers banned and the deposit on returnables raised to the level where people will not blithely toss them out their windows. Concern is growing in the U.S. and Canada about post-traumatic stress disorder exhibited by our soldiers in combat zones. In wars past, those suffering these symptoms were considered malingerers. They were shot for cowardice. Then, in World War I, this was termed shell shock, and sufferers were merely shunned. Only now do we recognize that those with symptoms related to fears, traumas, and horrors of war have a very real medical condition. But I did not want to harp on PTSD. It's the increasing awareness of this syndrome that interests me, and the corresponding ignorance of a related problem, drug addiction. I can't recall hearing or reading a single mention of drug use by Allied military personnel. This is especially remarkable when I consider that our soldiers are in Afghanistan. In that benighted country, opium poppies are a major crop. Afghanistan is the source of some of the world's most powerful and cheap hashish. Are we to believe that our soldiers are immune from the temptation offered by these products? When I traveled through Afghanistan in 1972, I was offered hashish on the streets for 2 Afghanis a gram. That was about 3 U.S. cents. At retail, that worked out to $30 per kilo. Essentially, it was free. Opium and its derivatives like heroin were likewise dirt cheap, although I never availed myself of the opportunity to use any drugs there, as penalties for those caught were draconian. There's no reason to believe that narcotics are either expensive or hard to find in today's chaos and desperation of Afghanistan. Consider the fact that marijuana helped end the American war against Vietnam. I've been told by men who were soldiers in the field that entire units would be stoned to the point where they refused to fight. Discipline collapsed in a fog of smoke. I can't believe the Canadian soldiers have not succumbed to the temptation to use drugs. What I can believe is that there is a silent agreement between the military and news media not to mention narcotics use. They well know that a scandal involving illicit use could undermine support for the mission on the home front. I eagerly await a news outlet finally having the temerity to breach the wall of silence, admit to the presence of this explosive elephant in the room. Canada's federal and Alberta's provincial governments will spend $778 million to subsidize a power plant experimenting with carbon capture and storage, or CCS. New technology will be used in building a coal-fired electrical facility near Edmonton. This comes on top of $865 million lavished on Royal Dutch Shell to install CCS equipment at a tar sands upgrader, also near Edmonton. Carbon capture and storage sounds like a great idea. Great, that is, for researchers and those supplying and installing expensive equipment for these projects. The idea of pumping underground, carbon underground, appeals. Out of sight, out of mind. But gas isn't going down into a vacuum. It must displace something, be it solid, liquid, or gas. Gas down, rock up? Not likely. Maybe underground air pockets will be replaced. If so, what would keep CO2 from mixing with that air and coming right back up into the atmosphere? More likely, injection will force up water from deep aquifers. If this is pristine water, fit for human consumption, would it be captured for use or discharged as waste? If the water is not pristine and it's discharged into waterways, this whole project would merely exchange one pollutant for another with no net benefit. All in all, this looks to be a dead-end technology serving only as eyewash for a concerned public, a profit center for big corporations, and a financial opportunity for traders in carbon credits. As for me, I have my own plan. While public money is still being thrown at the CO2 problem, I intend to submit a proposal to governments for a piddling research grant of $10 million bucks or so. In their rush to shovel money out the door, this might slip through. My proposal is to research the possibility of separating CO2's carbon from oxygen. The carbon would be compressed into commercial-grade graphite. This could be feedstock for a pencil factory here in Prince George. I could probably get Prince George to kick in a million or two in the promise of creating hundreds of jobs. What the hell, it worked with a chopstick scheme, so, but not once, but twice. Failing the graphite project, with a bit of time and pressure, this carbon could be compressed into diamonds. That ought to put dollar signs in their eyes. As to the oxygen, I'll propose combining it with hydrogen via a simple process, commonly called fire, to create pure water, another commodity in increasingly short supply. Certainly my proposal has as much merit as pumping gas underground, hoping it won't escape, and mine is much cheaper. Once my grants come through from a grateful government, I'll begin my research. My first chore will be searching out which is the best nation, preferably with a warm and peaceful one, lacking an extradition agreement with Canada, where I can move my assets while investigating the virtues of a long life of beachfront leisure. Speaking of subsidies, documents have just come to light revealing how Italy's Mussolini, during World War II's Il Duce, got his leg into politics. In 1917, he was on the take for £100 a week from Britain's MI5 while he was a journalist. Britain used purchased Italian writers to spin propaganda, assuring continued public support for their part as allies of Great Britain in the war. Without this bit of overseas bribery, World War II might have been quite different. Suppose Italy under Mussolini had not jumped into bed with Hitler and instead resisted the Führer's plan to conquer the world. We'll never know. One thing is for sure. Governments continue to support tyrants for perceived short-term benefits without regard to how their pet snakes may come back to bite them in the future. One thinks of Hamid Karzai as the latest corrupt bastard to be on the take. Where might he surface when the Afghan war is finally lost? Does anyone remember when Gordon Campbell swore to maintain medical funding? You do? Go to your room. You aren't supposed to hang on to promises after an election is over. Such pledges have become inoperative in today's new fiscal environment. Anyway, Campbell's government isn't cutting services, it's reallocating them. His latest reallocation will see the end of Prince George Northern Health Authority's providing inoculations for overseas travelers. But not to Murray. By the merest of coincidence, a private company, Travel Medicine and Vaccination Center, will be opening a clinic in Prince George on the 1st of December, the very day that our public service terminates. Now, what are the chances of that, eh? A series of preventive inoculations by this private company will cost no more than $30 above current fees. What the hell, those who can afford to travel can afford $30 extra. And those not paying for shots and returning with exotic diseases won't be the problem for Travel Medicine and Vaccination Center. They'll be treated at public expense. Watch for our provincial liberals' next reallocation of resources to screw us out of more services we expect from our tax dollars. Humbug. Now here's a quotation from an anonymous church homily. Quote, "Spending time in theaters produces fornication, intemperance, and every kind of impurity." See you at the Odeon, eh? This brings an overdue end to my 331st Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia.